Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.
There's a long history of this. Would I assume that at some point this would happen? Yeah. Was I surprised when it happened? No. And I can tell you that in the solar industry, everything that is happening has happened before in one way or another. We keep repeating ourselves.
The Department of Commerce's long-awaited preliminary determination in the Auxin Solar tariff petition is here. The agency has found that some solar manufacturers in Southeast Asia have been circumventing tariffs against China, signaling that additional tariffs could be on the way once President Biden's moratorium ends in 18 months. The news puts added pressure on solar module availability, as the industry still reckons with supply tied to forced labor. I'm John Engle, Content Director for Renewable Energy World. This week on Factor This, we're joined by industry veteran Paula Mintz, who's been tracking the solar industry for more than two decades. She joins us to break down the latest from Commerce and to discuss the industry's path forward amid mounting headwinds. That's all next on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. Paula Mintz, thanks so much for joining the Factor This podcast. Good to see you.
Thank you for asking me. It's good to see you too, John.
Yeah, of course. So before we get too far into the results of the preliminary findings from Commerce in the Auxin Solar tariff petition case, why don't you give us an idea of a little bit about your background and your career path and what you're working on now?
Well, I've been doing the same thing for 25 years, so pretty much doing the same thing and my plans are to continue doing the same thing. I'm a solar market research analyst. I started 25 years ago at Strategies Unlimited, which was at the time, I think, one of two solar market research firms. Nobody was interested in us then. You know, I analyzed the industry the first year that over 100 megawatts were shipped, you know, a big year, right? Now it's nothing. Basically, I'm a classic market researcher. I count things. To a market researcher, it's like an economist. You know, the past is more important than the future. Nobody can foretell the future. And we can take a look at very long trend line and say, okay, this is what I expect to happen. But essentially, that's what I'm doing, counting things a very specific way so that I can assess what's happening and what the potential of what is going to happen for my clients and my industry. That would be it. Boring.
Yeah. Well, not boring to the people listening to this podcast. I'm sure. I mean, we'll consider this their free preview into some of your work.
Well, a lot of them get a lot of previews because I do put stuff up on LinkedIn on my blog on occasion, and I do have clients that read me. And I think when I was speaking, when I was doing that for, you know, part of my work, right, traveling around to conferences and speaking, I think one year I spoke at 60 conferences. So I don't think it's entirely unknown. So anyway.
Well, and I appreciate your insights, and you're right. You are very forthcoming with the market research that is, you know, proprietary to your organization, but it is great to see it on the outside too. We're all trying to read the tea leaves and see where this industry is going and the impact of so many different things that are going on. One of those being this Auxin Solar tariff petition case, which this podcast launched covering. So we started off with, you know, four in-depth episodes, including an interview with Auxin CEO Mamoun Rashid. And that was the starting point for this idea of what Factor This would become. And so I wanted to circle back now that we have heard from Commerce finally before the end of the year on how it views the merit of Auxin's petition. Can you walk us through what Commerce said in these now, you know, a week plus ago?
Well, I think that you sort of have to go back to the petition itself and look at the argument in the petition. So going back even further, yeah, their earlier petitions about dumping were accurate and correct. And I can understand both the demand side concern. We want less expensive because of the cost issues and margin issues on the demand side. And on the supply side, it's very hard to compete with module product that's shipped in to compete with you at below margin, low margin cost you can't possibly replicate because they're well supported. So that goes, all goes back a very long way. And I can see both sides because honestly, I have to spend my life seeing both sides. So this petition wasn't specifically about dumping. This petition was about evading tariffs by establishing manufacturing in other countries, sort of the pass through. This petition argued, as I was forced to read it in excruciating detail, as I've spent the week reading IRS documents in excruciating detail. The original petition based much of its logic on a very flawed report. I'm not going to name who wrote the report. Everybody can look that up. And the report used the logic that of the money, not on the additional value, that the additional value was somehow associated with the money spent. And so you cannot argue this, right? It's inarguable that most of the money is from metallurgical silicon through to the wafer, right? Of course, polysilicon is very expensive. Metallurgical silicon production, very expensive. All the way through to the end of the wafer. Yeah, there's more money there than there is in manufacturing the cell. But I and pretty much every expert I know, would argue that the science is in the cell. So if you're looking at the added value to produce electricity, that is in the cell. I don't have my data in front of me right now, but a significant portion of cell manufacture is in Southeast Asia. So yes. Chinese manufacturers manufacturers based in China did expand into Southeast Asian countries for more than one reason: cost of production. Though it's hard to beat, as we know, what else is going on in the U.S., it's hard to beat free labor. So they moved partly for labor, partly for incentives, and also to avoid tariffs, right? You could look at the argument there. If Longi and Jinko and Trina choose to establish cell manufacturing in the U.S. to avoid tariffs and serve the U.S. markets, are we going to have another petition about that? I mean, it's at a certain point you have to step back and go, okay, pretty much everybody does it. I'm not saying that's an okay thing. I'm certainly not going to say that about forced labor.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that is correct. They moved and there is module assembly. For module assembly, you can make somewhat of an argument. Yeah, you're shipping the cells, which are the electricity producing device to, part of the module, to Southeast Asia, and then you assemble it into a module and you ship it on. You can make the argument a little more clearly there, although I would still argue there's a lot of art and science and engineering that goes into module assembly. But you can make the argument better there. When you start to say that the cell is of little added value, that's just a little added value, you lose me and pretty much, again, any expert I know, because you're not going to generate electricity from a wafer. So in my opinion, it was a flawed argument, and thus, if it's a flawed argument, it's the incorrect decision. If you're going to take a look at the money and not the merit of where the science is, that is my issue with their decision. Now, how it's likely to affect the U.S. market? The U.S. market is already having problems. So you're already looking at a situation where it's difficult. You have to, there's a delay at the port, the variable I'm sure you've talked to developers who are literally, you sign a variable contract, which means you're just basically signing an estimate of what your price will be. It's very hard to run a business that way. And I would argue that you're not going to see these variable contract prices go down. Even though prices are going down, poly prices are going down, wafer prices are going down, cell prices are going down. So you should see some relief, right? But you're not. And I think it's unlikely that you will. So this will cause manufacturers out of Southeast Asia, other than the four that were not found to have circumvented, to have a little pause before shipping into the U.S. to potentially raise their prices. They're going to have to prove now that they aren't circumventing, because though this decision, as I understand it, was just on these four manufacturers, they're sort of a stand-in for the entire region. So moving back again to the way Commerce decided to do this, choosing eight manufacturers as a stand-in for an entire region is flawed, in my opinion, in and of itself, you know?
Yeah, so that was let's dive into that a little bit for those that don't know. When the petition was filed targeting those four Southeast Asian countries, the way Commerce
it started with the countries,
but to your point there, just to parse that out a little bit, the way that Commerce investigated was almost by taking a sample of the region by picking out eight companies and seeing who is doing well and who is not. And I think most in the industry on the developer side, you know, who are procuring these modules will tell you that they expected, you know, some to be found to not be doing the most above board work. I do think it is interesting that we're now in this position where you're right. It's four companies that get the slap on the wrist. The entire region gets the label. And it doesn't really seem like there's a ton of clarity about whether or not we got our answer of if this was broadly happening in the region.
Hey, Factor This listeners, it's John Engel. I wanted to let you know that you can now watch every new episode of the Factor This podcast on YouTube. Just search Renewable Energy World and leave a rating and review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
No, it's analogous to polling, which is a subset of market research. It's really a hard job because you're taking a very small sample size to assess how people, in the case of voting, are going to vote. And so the classic market research, the way I do it, and others, I hope, you have a lot of data, and that smooths over the misrepresentations. I'll just put it that way. But here, Commerce looked at, they got a flood of responses and essentially believed they did not have the time to do them justice. Then again, going back, so they used a sample similar to polling, a very small sample size. So, and they're making broad assumptions based on the sample size. But it's all based on the assumption that it's where the money lies and not where the science lies. I don't know if this was argued or not by the solar demand side and solar associations in the US, but to me, that's actually the argument. You're arguing the money, not the science. It's really money and science, in my opinion. So, you know, now there's a delay. They're going to respond. You can still continue to buy from them if they're willing to ship to you as long as you install within 6 months. Most large developers are buying now for 2024. So that's why would, you know, come on. Others are going to have to answer questions. It's May 2023 before they're going to render a final decision. All tariffs are paused until June 2024 anyway, based on, I would assume, the assumption that we'll have manufacturing in the U.S. of the cell. We have a lot of module assembly. We only have for solar, really, you know, some smaller other thin film manufacturers that are manufacturing cells. So it's problematic, but right now, I would say the market feeling the most pain is markets are probably the U.S. and India. India, because the government closed a loophole that developers there and others were crawling through.
So who got identified by Commerce as circumventing and who is in the clear for now? How did the eight shake out?
BYD in Cambodia, Canadian Solar Thailand, Trina Solar Thailand, Vina. And which is Longi, Hanwha, Malaysia, Jinko Malaysia, Nui Solar Cambodia for some reason, and Boviet Vietnam are in the clear.
Any surprises there on how it split?
I'm stuck on the surprise that they found in favor just on the base of the money, period. You know, I mean, again, some of these are really just module assemblers and it's hard to understand how they split this, but we'll see in the comments. I mean, Longyi had already pulled back on production in Vietnam based on this, likely feeling that they had that the odds were they would be found as having circumvented.
You keep mentioning the value and the science. So what commerce is looking for in this case to determine if Chinese manufacturers are circumventing the tariffs, the duties against that country by operating in Southeast Asia, is measuring the value that is added from going from, you know, wafer to cell in the process, right?
Well, yes, kind of. So if you recall the earlier petition, having again read it in painful detail, mm-hmm. it was based on a report from another entity that essentially looked at the money spent. And the money spent is absolutely, there's more money from silicon metal. Oh, this, forgetting silicon metal, which I don't even think they mentioned. There's more money spent from poly through wafer than there is cell through module. There's still a ton of money in all of it, by the way. But if you're just, they're basing it on the money. And that transferring the cell manufacturer or the module assembly or both to these countries was just adding that there's little value. And if you're going to look at straight on dollars, yeah, if you're going to look on the science of it, the cell is what produces electricity. It's hard to look at that as just a little added value in my mind.
It comes down to how you define value. Is it the work?
Exactly.
Is it the work or is it the dollar and cents?
Put it in more simply. Is it what generates electricity? Because that's not the wafer. That's not the chunk of coal that produces the silicon metal, something else people in our industry don't think about very often, right, by the way. And also that quite a bit of what is produced in China, which is most of what is produced using coal as energy. So you may cut this out, but we really do need to start looking at these things and not taking a defensive YS posture. You can look at it actions that I think the U.S. is actions concerning the Uyghurs and forced labor in China, and that now suddenly everybody, UN, et cetera, are starting to realize, oh, my gosh, this is a bad thing. Right. So the U.S. took a stand and it's made it painful for people in the U.S., but it's the right stand. And so there are a lot of stands we don't take in the industry because in the end, you know, although we're still a young industry, this is really big business. In this particular, back to what you'd actually like to talk about, I think, honestly, this was, I mean, I can't restate this enough. This is a flawed petition, and I'm unsurprised that it prevailed. But nonetheless, it comes down to me to how you're defining value.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the whole point of the case, too. And, you know, the industry, you know, through its trade organizations has fought back against this petition at every stage. And at one point, you know, accusing President Biden and the Biden administration for being anti, you know, renewable energy altogether, just for even allowing commerce.
Don't you think that's a little bit of a gaslighting argument?
I do. And that was kind of the crux of the 4-episode series that we did on the Oxen Solar petition. And so we launched that podcast at a time when the industry was terrified about what was going to happen next. And we tried to go as middle of the road as we could to say, look, you may not like that it's happening this way, but the reason for it happening may not be wrong in terms of the decisions that the industry has made to get to where it is, to find those economies of scale. You made your bed, and you know, now we're kind of dealing with the ramifications of a lot of different decisions.
You know, it also comes down to how you're defining economies of scale. So there's a one of the many real problems here in the industry. We base our arguments to governments and to people who buy our electricity on the fact that we are going to be the cheapest form of electricity in the world. Who wants to be defined as cheap? So we have valued us based on cheap. By the way, that value is based on cost and usually on back back, you know, engineering, reverse engineering the price from China, which is so supported on so many levels and so subsidized that it is not an accurate representation of cost. At this point in the industry, we do not know what anything costs. However, if you're on the demand side and you're trying to make a living and you've been enjoying these very, very low prices below 30 cents before all this started to happen, which was not an accurate representation of cost. You have to have margin here, right? So you've got the demand side making plans and signing contracts. It's PPAs all over the world and bidding on auctions based on these very, very low, unsustainable prices. Meanwhile, if you want to talk about economies of scale and define it this way, China is building, they're not evil, okay? They are building up their manufacturing base to the point where it's not a buyer's market. It really never was. And they proved that when they wanted to. Lots of high margins this year if essentially the government allows you to continue to produce. Lots of really, really healthy margins going on there. That's another argument. Because problem we have. We do not value margins the way we should when we're making this sort of when you're producing this product, you need a gross margin in the 30% range. If you look at like industries, you're going to see 25 to maybe even 40%. That's because you're running a company, all the quality control, et cetera. So then we look at another problem. It's just, I've been watching this for years, poor performance in the field. Because we've cut out quality control on the manufacturing side. So this isn't the only problem we're facing. I would think at this point we would like to encourage manufacturing in the US. And likely if some manufacturers from China want to establish cell production in the US, do we want to discourage them by telling them that, hey, you're avoiding tariffs? Sure they are, right? Anyway, it's sort of a complex situation where you have a buying side that's gotten used to very, very low prices for a really long time and the expectation that we're going to go like this forever, suddenly realizing they have very little control over the price function in their industry that has nothing to do with economies of scale in China, by the way. And or not that you can find, since you can't, it's hard to find real data. And it's a painful awakening. Now, this may be really good for establishment of manufacturing in the U.S., which will in no way be. You will have modules not as cheap as you can buy in the past. No way. Right. Because we have labor laws, for one thing. Mm-hmm. People need to make a decent wage to live. You got to pay health care. But maybe they'll be more accepting of it. And maybe down the line, we'll stop valuing solar generated electricity as the cheapest form of electricity, but as a way to be independent and lead to a distributed electricity generation future. And utility scale is great, too. We need all of it. So, I mean, maybe it'll be helpful to U.S. manufacturers who hope to establish manufacturing in the U.S., but in the end, it's just a bad decision, in my opinion. It's just a flawed decision based on a flawed argument.
You know, you've been following and watching the industry closely for more than two decades. Maybe not in this way. Did you expect that the industry would get tripped up because of its supply chain imbalance? But did you expect it to come to a head eventually, that there was going to be this reckoning that, you know, that race to the bottom on price that you were talking about with 20-year contracts is pushing developers into more and more vulnerable positions?
I always expected this, and I've always written about this. And since I've been following the tariffs since they, you know, I mean, I actually, in one of my publications, went through the history of tariffs in the United States. So I actually always expected that. I don't expect anything. I mean, I have to be clear, I'm an observer and an analyst, and I look at the trends. So if you look at if you just look at the U.S. history of tariffs way back to before we had federal income tax, which basically that's how the United States as a young country supported itself. Its revenue came from tariffs. And then income tax somewhat mitigated that. But there's a long history of this. So would I assume that at some point this would happen? Yeah. Was I surprised when it happened? No. But market research, honestly, is all about looking back at the past and long trend lines. And I can tell you that in the solar industry, everything that is happening has happened before in one way or another. We keep repeating ourselves. So that's the joy of being a boring market research analyst that has people fleeing from her at parties when they ask simple questions like, "Wow, solar's great. What do you think?" So basically, in terms of did I expect this, I expected it and didn't expect it. I'm just following the trends.
Yeah,
it's just my work.
Well, and you've mentioned a couple of times also, separate from this tariff case, is the human rights concerns surrounding certain modules produced in China. In the research that you're doing right now, how do we quantify the scale of the issue? Like, do we have any idea of how much supply is being held up at the border and what impact this is having on the market?
Well, okay. I'm just going to, I hope you won't cut this bit out. who is being impacted more in terms of forced labor? Our market or the Uyghurs? I mean, so I'm asked this question a lot, and that's honestly my answer.
Yeah.
That's honestly my answer. If you are essentially a modern slave in China, all the way through China, by the way, if you're a modern slave in China, do you really care that a few modules are being held up on the port? Who's suffering, really?
You're right.
Is our fiscal suffering worse than that? I don't think anybody's bothering to say that out loud, but I am. It's gigawatt levels that are getting stalled because they have to go through the painful process of proving. I think some JNCO just got released. So nobody knows for sure, because the way the Customs Border Patrol, CBP, assesses this stuff is kind of different from what we do. You have to keep asking them. If you're a journalist, you have to ask them, OK, how are you defining this shipment? You know, but it definitely gigawatts a level because it slows everything flowing through. And so it should. Unfortunately, that means the planning horizon for developers has changed. And that affects the variable contracts, because time at the port, somebody's going to pay for it, right? That port time is not free. Waiting for a customs CBP to assess whether or not there's forced labor in the background, that's very slow. And although there are manufacturers in China and Southeast Asia and elsewhere, because it just flows, because it starts with the metallurgical silicon, and Hoshine is a huge provider. Also, silicon gels to the U.S. So it's not just us, but it just bogs everything down, and somebody has to pay those port charges. So that leads to higher prices. That's why, unfortunately, one of the reasons our variable contracts are unlikely to go down despite lower prices for poly wafers, you know, cells. So it's a gigawatt level problem with things dripping through like that and having to be consistently prepared. It's not one we shouldn't have been prepared for. I know that 2 years ago, I sent spreadsheets around my clients asking, you know, basically, here are the questions you ask all the way metallurgical silicon through.
About your sourcing.
Yeah, exactly. But it's very tedious to do that. And I suspect that some didn't believe we would get to this point. And I think they're just waking it up to it in Europe, and they're starting to move in this direction. It's going to take longer. And, you know, kudos to the U.S. for standing up. But yes, there is pain on the demand side because of this. Most would probably prefer it not be regulated. But if it's not regulated, product will still get in that traces back to, again, the people who are really impacted.
Yeah. And I'm glad you did state it that way, because it is so easy when you're, especially in an industry, you know, a trade media medium, it's easy to skip through those yeah. headlines and the lead and get right to, okay, how is this impacting our developers? Because that's our audience. You know, that's the conversations that we're having every day. But you're totally right that this is not just a technology story. This is a very human, you know, event that is happening.
I'll give you another human event. You and I are on, I'm on a laptop, right? You have a cell phone. I have a cell phone. Tesla batteries, solar batteries, LG solar batteries. If they're cobalt based as a stabilizing agent, most of the world's cobalt comes from Congo. The Republic of Congo, where there is forced labor and forced child labor. So we have in the RE industry as a whole a lot to reckon with. And how you change it at this point, it's, I'm still using my iPhone. You know, I mean, we, you know, there's a lot of culpability here, and it's so hard to change. Believe me, this is my industry. These are my people. I love it. I do this work. I do a lot. I help a lot of people, you know, if I can, with less than I give my clients, of course, because, or I wouldn't have a business, but enough. I don't charge really high prices. I want my industry to succeed. But I'd like to, it to succeed without, I'd like to, it to succeed with its eyes open. And I would like this discussion to start off with who the real answer to who is the most impacted, as just as you just said.
Yeah. And that leads us to the more macro conversation about the resiliency of our supply chains here in the U.S. and the onshoring of manufacturing and cell manufacturing, and not just module. Like you mentioned, you use the word, I think, a lot of module. I mean, we still only have like 10 gigawatts, I think, of production capacity thereabouts.
But it's module assembly, which module without a cell is a frame.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we have almost no cell. And so that is an important point here. And the Inflation Reduction Act was supposed to be that jumpstart to bring the industry back home, so to speak, and to have greener supply chains. Like you mentioned, a lot of the process in China is powered by coal generation, and also improve the reliability of deliveries, which our developers also, you know, complain about fairly regularly, that the modules that they're procuring from Southeast Asia are not reliably delivered when they want them to. We have this 2-year pause, which presumably President Biden made that length for a couple of reasons. One being that goes through his first term. The other being that he doesn't look like he's just, sitting back and letting China do whatever it wants. Is there any reason to believe that 2 years down the line, the trade organizations will once again pool their money? $5 million was what they spent in the lead up to the pause. They spend it again. The pressure campaign is back on. President Biden wins re-election, or a Democrat holds the White House, and the pause is reinstituted. Are we just going to get into this cycle where, as long as Democrats have control of the federal offices that they need, that we can keep punting it down the line?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily agree with your characterization of why the decision was made. However, if you look at history again, market research is about looking back, establishing trends over time. Yeah, of course we will. This is the way it is. It's been this way with the ITC, with the PTC when it was just wind. It's been this way all along. You get close to the end date and you start, all the developers say, we're going to lose our businesses. Yeah. That's the argument they need to make, right? So then it gets extended. And honestly, the ITC and PTC tend to get extended on a bipartisan basis. The tariffs, Republicans and Democrats extend them. So my concern about, I've done a lot of work studying India's. India is providing incentives for the capacity building. We are providing incentives for production, basically sales, right? Shipments. Mm-hmm. So neither India nor the U.S. are long enough to actually have the manufacturing they want in the U.S. if they want quality manufacturing. One problem here is we're looking at China and assuming, oh, wow, that's the way it's done. Look how quick. Yeah. You install the equipment, you're producing commercial production right away. You got to calibrate the equipment. You've got pilot scale you have to do, you know, at least 2 years, at least, right? So, and that's too short, but at least 2 years. So you're looking at a very accelerated timeline to have commercial production of crystalline in the U.S. Again, part of that 10 gigawatts or so is for solar, a significant part of it, most of the cell production. So if you're looking at the what we need or what we would like in cell production, you need a little longer. Plus, manufacturers then have to climb through all of these other hoops. They have to climb through permitting. First of all, the best way to get financing is a loan guarantee. They have to crawl through the loan guarantee process and then get some financing. And then, you know, it's and then buy the equipment, get the equipment delivered, calibrate the equipment, start pilot scale production. It's a while, right? Does that sound reasonable? Like it's 2 years? Does it even sound reasonable? No, it does not. So just rhetorically there. So, yeah, all of this is going to be in, you know, a few years. You're going to have SEIA, who, if there are more manufacturers here, I would hope would have representation made up equally of manufacturers and developers and the small guys, the residential guys, right? We need a little bit wider representation in SEIA than we have right now. Not, I mean, SEIA does great work. I'm not insulting them.
But you are pointing to the imbalance that it is by and large the interest of utility scale developers that are represented.
Yes, we need a more balanced SEIA. And if we are going to have manufacturing here, I hope one would assume that the makeup of SEIA would lean towards that a little bit. So that's a question for SEIA to answer down the road. What does SEIA want to be? It's our lobbying organization. They're going to need to work for the manufacturers too, in which case they're going to be stuck in a sort of the sort of the uncomfortable position of okay, do we argue for tariffs or against them, right? This is all very complicated because it goes back to infant industry theory, which I don't know if anybody's aware of, right? But it's essentially that you provide tariffs and support. This is decades old in the U.S. I mean, decades and decades old. And you provide tariffs and support to start up a manufacturing industry and then magically to keep it from low priced being driven out by close low priced imports. And then magically it's supposed to stand on its own 2 feet. That's why you don't see an end to this stuff. And there are so many flaws in infant industry theory that, you know, it's hard. You need another podcast for that. But it's not going to work, right? So that argues for this is just going to keep happening. One would hope we would in 2-3 years have a healthy manufacturing industry, you know, that's supplying most of what we can consume here. I doubt it. It's going to be all. But COVID showed us that a disruption to the globalization, I would argue that if everything's produced in China and Southeast Asia, that it's not real. How globalized is that? We have nothing here but a smattering, a module assembly and a thin film manufacturer, a large one, but still. So it showed us that supply chains cannot be relied on in a major disruption. So like climate change, wars and droughts and war and pandemics. It's in our best interest to establish manufacturing here and to nurture it. And for honestly, SEIA to start now on including manufacturers in the decision-making on their board, in their ranks, so that we can have that healthy industry. Nothing against SEIA. They've done great work. Honestly, done great work. But if we're going to have that balanced industry, we need a balanced industry association outlook, in my humble opinion.
So you were talking earlier about, too, that we don't really know the price of anything either because of the way that
China... We don't know the cost of anything. We don't know the cost of anything.
The cost. Right. Sure. Right. So given that we don't know the cost, how do we even analyze the reach of the problem? And is it naive to think that something like the Inflation Reduction Act and its 10-year timeline is enough to meaningfully move the ball down the field when you know that China is also not going to sit back and watch its manufacturing base evaporate?
I think that the variable contracts and difficulty getting product and the high price we're paying may have. We'll see if it. We have to wait and see if it changes things for the long term. In my experience, it doesn't, when once cheap prices come, developers will have back end, developers will have to make a hard decision about whether they want to support a reliable chain that is based in the US. Same for European developers, by the way. Or if they're going to go back to buying whatever is cheapest and what most available. But it all goes back to how we value solar electricity and our understanding that every time we install a solar system, whether it's utility scale, commercial, rooftop, we're installing the means of production, which isn't cheap. I mean, that's a whole huge, that's where the upfront cost is, right? And then you get the lower, then you get a relief on electricity prices plus independence. Anyway, right now we don't have a reliable baseline. So we're still, and that probably still includes the DOE, although I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not saying it as a fact. The assumption is that we're still chasing this, okay, we're going to be the cheapest form of electricity out there goal. And that, unless that is revamped based on the reality that we don't really know what things cost anymore to manufacture, it's going to be hard to stand up an industry if we really don't understand. Because when the cost of manufacturing here is higher, it's going to be shocking, right? Then again, if you look at everything that supports the low cost, thus price of what has come out of China, it's slave labor in some part. It is coal. It is subsidies. It is still a lot of gray debt over there. It's, you know, we haven't had a healthy reckoning on what things should cost in the industry because our assumption is still based on, okay, this must be reality here. So, and then everything goes down from this artificial point. It's one of the things we need to resolve in this industry, and we really should resolve it soon.
A final determination in the Oxen Solar tariff case is expected from the Department of Commerce on May 1st of 2023. Thank you to Paula Mintz for joining this episode of the Factor This podcast. Factor This is a production of Renewable Energy World and Clarion Energy. Join us every Monday as we break down solar's most important topics with industry leaders who actually move the needle. And please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.